Thank you, Axel. So, thank you for coming. It's a big room. Don't let the... I'm happy for questions. What I'm trying to do here is to tell you about a formalism and an approach that has been very successful in a related field, and I think it'll be a good way to approach this small-scale part of the MHD Shear-Off Pain Cascade. So, as Axel said, I'm at the University of Maryland. Prasad Subramanian, is now at NRL and was at George Mason, introduced me to this problem a year ago, and so I have him to thank. And then while I've been here, I've been working with Steve and Ellen, neither of whom can be here, so I can, all the errors are theirs. Normally I would claim them as mine. But no, actually, this errors are going to be mine, but they've been very helpful. And these folks are people in the fusion community that have been have helped with the code development and model development in the past. Okay, so what is it that I'm going to try to talk to you about? And again, any questions, no problem. I'm interested in the tail of an MHD cascade. So if you have some large-scale instability and a long inertial range, and then you come to the small scales, where, by small scales I mean, where the perpendicular wavelengths are comparable to a proton or ion Larmor radius. So K perp rho is order 1. At these scales, the Goldreich-Sridhar Shear-Off Pain Cascade is very well described by something called gyrokinetics, which I'm going to attempt to acquaint you with. And gyrokinetics is a 20-year-old formalism that's been used extensively for the study of terrestrial plasmas. And so it's very interesting to me that there's now a problem in astrophysics where maybe we can use this sort of mature tool that's been through a lot. So I'm going to first talk a little bit about precisely what I mean by the tail. Then I'm going to mention what the astrophysical applications of note would be. This is a kinetic calculation rather than a fluid or MHD calculation, so I want to motivate for you why you would bother to do something so complicated. Then give you a short description of what gyrokinetic is and show you how we do the simulation and tell you what the expectations are. I'm not really going to present new results. I'll show that we can recover the work of Quatert and Gruzinov, who have been doing some linear calculations, which you've presumably seen at this meeting already, some of you. But really what I'm trying to do is show you a roadmap for where we want to take this as time goes forward. Okay. Skip the pretty picture for a minute. So the critically balanced cascade has a lot of features. Of interest to for the present talk are these four features. First of all, that it at the large scales, at least, it's a magnetized ideal MHD plasma that puts certain constraints on the collisionality. That the outer scale, which I'll denote throughout by a capital R, is basically an isotropic disturbance here at small wavelength, generated by counterpropagating shear Alphane waves in the plasma. The nonlinear frequency, or eddy turnover time inverse, is comparable to the linear frequency. And with these assumptions and only these, you can find that at least the shear Alphane branch of an MHD disturbance starting here will cascade in this way, such that K parallel is smaller than K perp. And if you have a wide range of scales between, I mean, if the cascade can go on for a while, you can develop quite an anisotropic structure so that you're dealing with the plasma at the point far from the energy containing range, so out here, is characterized by very small perpendicular perturbations and very long flux tubes. And it's kind of a turbulent spaghetti, if you like, something like that. And it turns out that this is exactly the region of interest for the fusion community for many years. And so this is what gyrokinetics is designed to describe. That is, these long flux tubes which are nonlinearly interacting with turbulence inside them. So that's the big picture of where we're going. The point here is that the energy is cascading to the small scales along the field much more slowly than it is perpendicular to the field. And so you get these highly complicated structures in the perpendicular direction and boring flux tubes along the field line. And when you get to a K-perp such that it's comparable to an inverse proton Larmor radius, which I denote by rho I, that's when you're entering the gyrokinetic regime. Okay. So just to show you that we can, this is just kind of a visual. First, I've got this hand-drawn thing to give you an idea of what I'm about to show you because it's a complicated picture. I'm about to put a graphic up which has a tokamak, which is a terrestrial plasma device. There's a major radius here. Z is up. And an axis rotation of this figure goes around this way in the phi direction. And what I'm going to show you is a cutaway view of an annular region of that plasma. Okay? So you, what you'll see is an annulus with some small-scale perpendicular turbulence, and that turbulence will be highly extended along the strong magnetic field, which is basically in the phi direction with a small tilt to it. All right, so that's what you're expecting to see, is very short scales in the perpendicular direction and very long scales in the parallel direction. And this is what a typical, that doesn't come out very well in this room, it's what a typical figure looks like. So we have some small perturbations. This really doesn't look so great, sorry. You have small perturbations on in the perpendicular direction, and you can see that these are contours of the electrostatic potential, let's say. So there's not much variation along the field line, and there's some pitch to the field lines, and the perturbations are following that. So it's just the regime that the Goldreich-Sriedhar cascade evolves into. Okay, the long, skinny perturbations and with structure in the perpendicular direction. This is a simulation from the code that I've developed that I'm going to tell you about how. So I'll tell you how this relates. But the point is, we have codes that work and describe these kinds of plasmas in the nonlinear regime, and so it'll be interest. The basic idea here is to try to extend MHD simulations that Jason has done into the nonlinear regime at very small scales, where the perpendicular scales are approaching the ion gyre radius, and to see what happens. Okay? That's right. The dominant magnetic field here is into the board. It is completely filled, and the simulation domain, because the scales perpendicular are small for the turbulence, we do an annulus, right? So we do a section. And to be completely clear about it, although I wasn't going to say this, but I will, really what's simulated here is a tube like this, and it's a very long tube which eventually fills this annulus. But, in other words, we're doing a very long tube with some magnetic field structure along it, some curvature, some magnetic shears, some things like that. And then we map it back into this for visualization. Okay? So we're very used to dealing with this highly anisotropic world. Okay. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Depends on the pitch of the field, exactly how that works. So it's a complicated yes, but basically yes. All right, so what are the astrophysical applications of interest that we've identified? There's two. One is the interstellar scintillations. And what's of interest here is that there are velocity fluctuations which have been observed at the scale of a few parsecs, so 10 to the 18 centimeters. And yet there are density fluctuations 10 orders of magnitude below that at the 10 to the 8 centimeter scale, which turns out to be just at rho I for the interstellar medium. And these density fluctuations have a Kolmogorov-like spectrum, which Peter Goldreich told us a week or so ago. He's arguing that the density fluctuations are related to this MHD spectrum, the Scheer Alphane spectrum. But there's a big missing link, and that is, how does this magnetic Scheer-Alphane cascade actually drive the density fluctuations, and why do they exist at the rho I scale and not some other scale? Now, so the skipping this for a moment, the questions that we're going to look at are these density fluctuations related to the MHD cascade? Now, Peter Goldreich is arguing, putting forth the argument that it's a passive scalar advection of some entropy disturbance at very large scales, and it gets chewed up, and then we see it as density perturbations at small scales. It turns out one expects from gyrokinetic arguments that I'm going to show you that you would get density fluctuations on the rho I scale. And so maybe you don't have to do anything so complicated as a passive advection of some large scale thing to small scales. In fact, it might be just a straightforward outcome of having the gyrokinetic scale. After all, it's pretty interesting to me that the density perturbations end up right at the scale where the gyrokinetics comes in, and I'm going to show you how that is related to the density perturbations. I'm learning this problem. What the gyrokinetic analysis is going to give is a spectrum of density fluctuations that's generally on the rho I scale. It might be 10 or 20 rho I, but hundreds of rho I wouldn't expect you to get that out of this. Right. Okay. Well, we can't deal. It's unlikely that this would have a direct impact on that part. Aha. So that might be fortuitous. Okay. Well, I only learned about this interstellar scintillation since I've been here. And by the way, I've only worked on these problems as an astrophysicist, if you will, for a couple of weeks. So these comments are especially helpful for me, figuring out where I stand.
Do you know what that means when the density fluctuations are scintillation? Does it mean that there is no power at large scales, so it's covered more only for smaller scales?
Well, this is the meat of Alex's comment. I understood from discussions with Ellen, who unfortunately is not here, that there was a piece of the spectrum at the 10 to the 8 centimeter scale which was particularly hard to understand. Now, if it's part of a larger spectrum and it smoothly goes into something else, then it's unlikely that this would be directly relevant. If there's a bump or some cutoff, that would be very interesting. And in particular, the cutoff. The work I'm going to show you is going to argue that you'd expect some kind of cutoff at the rho I scale. Okay. Oh, that's what Jason is referring to. That's right. Yeah. I'm ignoring that entirely. That's right. I'm going to grant for all but one slide of this talk that there is large-scale turbulence which generates a cascade, and then I'm going to look at the tail of it. Okay. Now, the mean free path in this problem is 10 to the 12 centimeters, so it's in between the scale where there's the fluctuations in velocity and the density fluctuations, meaning that at least at this rho I scale, you have collisionless physics. And a feature of gyrokinetics that's interesting is, or useful here, is that it's essentially a collisionless theory, so because it's kinetic. So we can deal with that kind of complication. Okay, the other interesting problem is ADAF models of black hole accretion, and I guess Elliott Quatert and perhaps Grusinov have both been here, talked about that. This is the problem that Prasad Subramanian originally was telling me about that I got very excited about. Basically, you have large-scale MHD turbulence seems to be associated with accretion flows through this MRI instability. So you have some source at very large scales of MHD turbulence. The ADAF models require, from the literature, it appears to be a strong requirement, that the ions are much hotter than the electrons. And the basic physics here is that the black hole is underluminous, and so the ions are getting all the heat and then are falling into the black hole. Ions radiate much less effectively than the electrons. So there's a solution. If the ions are very hot, then you can be losing a lot of the energy into the black hole and not seeing it as radiation. And these ADAF models, this is a key part of those models. But well, in fact, the well, that's right. It's not confirmed observationally, to my knowledge. I haven't seen anyone talk about that. But the model is inconsistent if you don't assume that. Well, in fact, that's the loop that I want to try to close here is given large-scale MHD turbulence and given the need that TI should end up being much larger than TE, is there a, at the tail of the cascade where the energy finally goes from the electromagnetic disturbances into the particles, does it all go into the ions? It has to go in at one part in a thousand to the electrons. In other words, 99.9% has to go into the ions, or the ADAF model needs to be reconsidered to some extent. And so that's the question. Elliot and Andre have been studying the physical mechanisms for this in linear gyrokinetics, basically, is exactly what they've been doing and presented here. What I want to do is extend that into the nonlinear regime and try to answer some of the questions that they've put forward in their pioneering effort, which is, how does this critically balanced MHD cascade change as you approach the ion gyre radius? Is Whistler turbulence excited? And can you get constraints on these global ADAF models by requiring, just the question that Axel was asking, by requiring that this microscale physics, which is to say the details of the cascade at small scales, be consistent with electrons getting no heating? And so those are the questions that I've identified so far. I should say that also in this ADAF problem, it's a strongly collisionless plasma. So because the temperatures are very high, the density is pretty low, these are, again, collisionless plasmas. Yeah?
Do you envision applying your theories to
Farallon? Yeah, well, I didn't put that on here because as I talked to people here, it wasn't clear to me that people believe that the Goldreich-Schriedhar cascade was appropriate for the solar wind because you have alphane waves going in one direction rather than in both. I'm not an expert on that, so I didn't identify it as a key problem that I would start to look at myself, but I'm anxious to hear more. Yeah. Ah.
So what?
No, it's at much, much larger, much, much smaller scales.
The.
Right, and these perturbations are well into the collisionless regime where there's no effect, the collisionality is very, very low. You'd have to go to much higher, much shorter wavelengths before the collisionality that you have could do anything.
You're looking at 10 to the 8th, right?
That's right. Shorter scales. That's correct. That's correct. Lambda II. Okay, thank you. I'm sorry. I'm used to, in our world, in the fusion world, that's what we mean. So it's ions streaming along the field line. That's exactly what it is. Thank you. Okay, so why bother with doing any kinetic theory at all? This is just going to be some simple ideas, and if I see any eyes glazing over, I'll zip through it and get to something more interesting. And I'll throw this. So basically, if you have long mean free path physics parallel to the field, phase mixing, which comes in two guises, Landau damping and transit time damping, which in this community is called Barnes damping, I guess, can be very important. And it's particularly when the plasma is diffuse or hot. So if you have a perturbation denoted by this green line with some wavelength lambda along the field line, and you have particles which are essentially free streaming along the field line because the mean free path is so long compared to this lambda, then such a perturbation will disappear in a very short amount of time, because there's some particles hit this point which will travel over to here, and these guys will travel over here, and it'll all get mixed up on a time scale of lambda over V thermal, where V thermal is the spread in these velocities. And I'm going to show you that in more detail in just a moment. And so this is kind of a collisionless damping, lambda damping, and that will be very important. Perpendicular to the field, kinetic theory is going to help with the finite Larmor radius averaging. And what you get out of that is basically two things. There's a minimum size perpendicular structure for low wavelength low frequency perturbations, which is generally around rho I scale for low frequencies, and there's also a phase mixed response to larger scales. So let me show both of those in sort of one slide of detail in each one. When I came here, I was impressed that all the talks are put on the web and you can point and click. So I made these slides with a little more detail than I'll go through carefully here, so that if anybody's interested, they can click on the talk, and all the information you need is here. Okay? So, but let's consider a very simple problem where we have a Boltzmann plasma with, going to do a one-dimensional problem, so we only have a z-direction. The distribution function evolves dfdt plus v dfdz, so a very simple problem. There's an initial condition, which is some perturbation along the field line, and let's say, for the moment, a Maxwellian distribution of velocities in that perturbation. So what happens to such a perturbation in time is a question that I want to answer. Well, if the perturbation has a simple, it's just a sine wave, let's say, structure along the field line, the solution to this equation is very simple. F is just, there's just a traveling wave, e to the ikz minus dt, very straightforward. But the interesting thing is, and so this F never goes away, right? It just gets more and more structure in as time goes on, but you don't lose any information. The interesting thing, though, is that the density, so an integral of F over velocity, so the density response is going to decay like e to the minus t squared, okay? And this is basically what the process underlying Landau damping, and the way the terminology that I'm using here is the density has e to the ikz minus dt. This is the phase of the perturbation. It gets mixed up by the ballistic motion of the particles, which are streaming along the field line and causing the perturbation to disappear. So the characteristic time over which this happens is the inverse of k parallel v thermal. That means if this parallel wavelength of a disturbance that you have in the plasma is much smaller than the mean free path, phase mixing will be very important. And this, in a plasma, now when we put in field source, when we put in Maxwell's equations, we care about the moments of F, because the moments of the distribution function give you the source terms for Maxwell's equations, so that's where you get your electric field, magnetic field, and such. And if all the moments are phase mixed, then waves in the plasma get heavily damped at this time scale. So this time scale is of order k parallel v thermal inverse. Now consider a very high beta plasma, such as has been argued would be the case in these ADAPTs by Quatert and Grusinov. When beta is very large, this time is very fast because the Alphane waves are moving fairly slowly through the plasma while the particles are whizzing around. They have much higher velocities. And that means that the damping rate from these collisionless processes can be very large, and your shear Alphane wave, which typically propagates undamped, can be damped out very rapidly when you get to a collisionless, when you get to the collisionless limit through this phase mixing kind of process. And this is the essential physics that Quatert and Grusinov were drawing upon when they talked about the damping of the Alphane waves in the Goldreich-Friedhardt cascade. So some people have already done astrophysical. Let's see. Let me do the gyrokinetics real quick. I mean the finite Larmor radius. This is a very simple example. If I have some electrostatic potential perturbation, this blobby looking thing that's in the turbulence, then that's a contour for particles to E cross B drift along, right? Because you put a potential in the plasma, the particles like to go round and round. And a particle which has a very small gyre radius compared to the size of this blob doesn't average over very much of that blob, and he will zip along at some drift velocity. A particle which has a larger gyre radius is averaging over more of the potential, is going to see, on average, a smaller potential, and so will drift more slowly. And so in the perpendicular direction around such a blob, you'll also get phase mixing. Okay? This is in the perpendicular direction rather than the parallel. So that's what I wanted to point out here. There's also another feature. Let's say that, now shifting gears, use the same figure, we have some blob which is very small compared to, let's assume for a moment that this red circle were the average size of the gyre radius in the plasma. Such a small perturbation is completely averaged over by the particles. And so small structures like that will tend to be rapidly brought out of the plasma. They don't survive very long because of the phase mixing and averaging. Okay. So people have done astrophysical kinetic calculations. There's two very good examples. Foote and Colesrud in 1979 calculated the collisionless damping of MHD modes at very high beta. And I recommend this paper if you're interested in the subject at all. It's maybe they spend more time than we would today on some asymptotic methods, but the basic physics there is very good. And they showed that the compressional modes, the compressional slow mode and the fast mode, are both heavily damped at high beta in a collisionless plasma, and give two examples of astrophysical problems where that might be of relevance. So this is kind of the godfather of this kinetic approach in astrophysical problems, first paper. And then recently, as I said before, Kwaterik and Gruzinov have been looking at linear collisionless damping of Alphane waves in these ADAS. Now, I think in the course of, after seeing Jim Stone's talk, actually, last week on the MRI, it appears that there's a calculation that should be done, which hasn't yet, which is the effect of collisionless damping, Landau damping, on the threshold magnetic field for an MRI instability. MRIs have a maximum growth rate, which goes like the rotational rate of the accretion disk. But they also have a growth rate, which is constrained to be some kz v alphane. Z here is pointing up out of the disk. And together, the rotation rate and the alphane speed determine which kz's will be, what the wave number of the perturbations will be for the instability. So we can calculate that. And certainly for ADAS, the plasma is so hot that the mean free path times this kz is much larger than 1, thereby completely violating the assumptions underlying the MHD model that the MRI instability is calculated with. And the original Baldus and Hawley paper discusses a couple of threshold criteria, but does not discuss a threshold criterion for a minimum field in the presence of collisionless damping. And I think that that would be a very straightforward calculation, for example, working from Foote and Colesrud. And it seems to me that it'll constrain the threshold field for an MRI to be much larger than has been appreciated. I think that's right. I have it all written down. Okay, so now we shift gears, and I want to talk to you more specifically about gyrokinetic theory in its detail. This is the slide that, if I've succeeded, you might be interested in these papers. So the basic nonlinear equations were derived in the early 80s in the limit that we've already discussed. These three papers are all very good. The first one is probably the most readable. It states very clearly what the various assumptions and orderings are. And the third one has the nonlinear ordering in some detail. So in particular, for getting the full structure with the gyro average, Maxwell's equations, and all of the details, you go to Anhedson Lane. And then for the nonlinear terms, which are of course very important, that's what we're bringing to the table, I think, in this case, you go to Freeman and Chen. So these papers are from the early 80s. Gyrokinetic simulations based on these equations have been used since that time to model turbulence in high-field laboratory plasmas. Now, the defining feature of the tokamak, unfortunately, is that the plasma beta, the ratio of the pressure to the magnetic field squared, is typically vanishingly small, a few percent. And what that means for the development of gyrokinetic simulation practices over the years is that most people simply assumed the plasma had zero beta and worked with electrostatic equations. And we've made quite a bit of good progress in that direction. However, nowadays there are new devices being built which have much lower field and therefore much higher beta. And so there's been an interest in the fusion community for beta equals one plasmas. Well, now it's fairly straightforward that we take our electrostatic codes, which have been compared with experiment and used in a variety of circumstances, and we can add the electromagnetic effects in and start to look. So the point is, although this has been around for 20 years, it's never been used for astrophysical problems because it's been in an astrophysically irrelevant limit where beta equals zero. Your plasmas always have, you know, beta of one or much larger.
So why do you say beta equals small implies electrostatic?
No, when beta is small? Well, it turns out that the perturbations... what's the best way to say it? The amplitude of the perturbed field goes like beta. If you go to the beta equals zero limits, you have no perturbed magnetic field in the waves. Oh, no, there's a strong field. Sorry, there's a strong equilibrium field, but the perturbations are treated as electrostatic perturbations. That's essentially. Yes. Yes. Well, that would be fine. I mean, that.
But then you wouldn't, I think, nobody would call it, I think.
An electrostatic plasma, right.
But they have stronger connection.
Right. Well, maybe I could be a little more honest and just say people started with what they could do, and with existing computers, people could only do electrostatic for a long time because having the range of scales. Okay, so you get a range of time scales when you put the electromagnetic waves into the problem, which is much more challenging to simulate. And it's only another parallel development here is that computers have gotten a lot faster, and so we're now able to actually do those calculations. So maybe we should have been doing it all along, but we got away without it. Okay, so gyrokinetics makes use of two conserved quantities. This will be very brief. Energy and magnetic moment. Energy conservation is familiar, and I just wanted to say a couple of words that magnetic moment, which is defined here to be mv perp squared over 2v, the equilibrium magnetic field, is an adiabatic invariant, which is to say that the change in the magnetic moment divided, the percentage change in the magnetic moment is very small as long as the frequencies of perturbations that you're looking at are very small compared to the cyclotron frequency. Okay? There's a very common example of adiabatic invariance. If you have a pendulum, which is swinging, it has some natural frequency, square root of g over l. Here's the length of the plasma. And if you slowly pull over the pulley, the string up at some rate l dot, and you make that rate divided by the length of the string small, so I'm going to make essentially the rate of change in the system from the external source is denoted by omega l. And if omega l is very small compared to the swinging frequency, you find that there's an adiabatic invariant in the problem, which is that the period, it's actually the period times the energy, but the energy is also conserved. So the change in the period, the percentage change in the period vanishes, goes to zero more faster than any power of epsilon. And so what happens? As you pull this up, the amplitude actually changes and goes up so that you get, you know, you start pulling on the pendulum and the frequency increases and it actually goes higher. And you can, it's a nice little example. It's very easy to work through. In a plasma, there's three main adiabatic invariants, which are all described in some nice detail in this 1957 paper by Colesrud. Another name familiar to this community. Okay, so that was what I meant to show you there was that the frequencies in the problem have to remain small compared to the cyclotron frequency for gyrokinetics to be valid. And that includes nonlinear frequencies in the problem. What that means is that nonlinear frequencies have to be small, means that the fluctuation amplitudes in this plasma actually have to be small. And normally when people start thinking about gyrokinetics, they immediately think, you mean if the perturbations have to be very small, why am I interested? This can't be turbulence. This is not a strong turbulent situation. But in fact it is. And really there's a very good description of this in Freeman and Chen paper that I pointed out. But let me just focus here. What gyrokinetics describes is small amplitude perturbations that are rapidly evolving compared to some background and yet slowly evolving compared to the cyclotron frequency. And the interesting thing about these perturbations that's relevant is that the gradients of the perturbations can be as large as the gradients of the background equilibrium. So in that sense, you have very strong turbulence mixing things around. I'm going to walk you through the example of the tail of the GS cascade and show you that in fact the amplitudes are small in the sense that I mean. Okay, and so the point is that you may hear that this limit describes only very small fluctuations, but in fact they're just the size fluctuations you expect from this Goldreich-Schriedhardt cascade. Okay, so let me show you that. I guess first I should show you what the gyrokinetic equation is. I've already talked to you and said what we're doing is averaging over the gyro motion of the particles in a formal sense. And so any frequency in the problem has to be small compared to the proton cyclotron frequency. It turns out that we require that the parallel wavelengths be very small compared to the perpendicular wavelengths for this description. Again, that happens to be exactly what you want in the tail of the MHD cascade. The perturbations have to be small. I just mentioned that. And the variation in the system, let's see, any equilibrium variations have to be small. L here measures any equilibrium variation, and that should be small compared to a gyro radius. In a tokamak, that's hard sometimes, but in an astrophysical plasma where you have an outer scale which is tremendous compared to an ion gyro radius, there's no problem. So I'll go through these carefully for you in a moment. Here's the structure of the kinetic equation. There's a time derivative. There's V parallel, free-streaming along the field. There's some curvature. If your flux tube is curved in space, then there's drifts of the particles introduced by that curvature. And those are all kept to all orders, as are, I'll talk more about that in a second. There's a collision operator. So here we typically use a velocity space collision operator. Since it's a kinetic equation, we have velocity space around, so we can do a full kind of Fokker-Planck operator. And then this term will not enter. This is equilibrium gradients, and we're going to start by considering problems where there's no equilibrium gradients. Certainly there are equilibrium gradients in astrophysical plasmas, but we can start without them. And then this is kind of a field variation term. Let's not worry about it for a second. The key thing here is that it's a simple kinetic equation of the form d by dt plus v times spatial derivatives. It's actually nonlinear in the sense that the d by dt is a convective nonlinearity. And this is the usual Poisson bracket, so the whole thing forms a Lie-Poisson structure. But basically you have the Poisson bracket of the distribution function with the field is the nonlinearity in the problem. The field is given down here. It's the gyro average vector potential in the Coulomb gauge. And basically, these Bessel functions, J0 and J1, they come from the particles' rapid gyration around their guiding centers. Okay? And so the field that the particles see that evolves the distribution function is the gyro average electrostatic potential and the vector potential, which here there's a parallel part which gives you the delta B in the perpendicular direction to the field line. This is like the shear Alphane part of a perturbation. And a compressional part, delta B parallel. That's the compression of the field line, compression of the magnetic field along the field line. Okay, and the distribution function is a five-dimensional object plus time. So the code is not a three-dimensional turbulence, it's five-dimensional.
The sound bracket, this involves the derivative of what?
That's right, it's just, it's just df dx dg dy minus the other way around. No, not in this case. Yeah, they're different in this case. Okay, so in addition to that, so in practice, in the codes, what's done is this h, which is a five-dimensional function, is pushed forward in time according to this equation. You need the fields, the potential, the perturbed magnetic field, and you get the fields from Maxwell's equations. Maxwell's equations are here, and I should have highlighted them. Let me just get you to focus on the bottom. There's an equation which tells you what phi is. This is Poisson's equation in the gyro average limit, which I don't want to bother you with for a minute. This is one of those examples where I'm going to put it on the web and you can look at it later. There's from parallel part of Ampere's law, there's an A parallel. Here, this is the charge times the velocity times the distribution function. So this is the current. Okay, so here's the current and here's the field. And similarly, there's a delta B parallel, and this expression is very similar to, here you have mv perp squared times the distribution function. That is the pressure moment of the distribution function. So it's gyro average, but let's ignore that for a minute and say you have the pressure moment plus delta B parallel over B equals zero. That's just familiar to you once you've taken out incompressible MHD. You have P plus B delta B equals zero. So this is the gyro average version of that. So gyrokinetics has ordered out, just like incompressible MHD, it's ordered out the fast wave.
And A is exponential.
That's right. Okay, so the Goldreich-Sridhar cascade is gyrokinetic when you get to these scales. Let me show you how that works. First of all, you satisfy the requirement that the fluctuations be sufficiently anisotropic. And that is that rho I over the outer scale of the turbulence to the one-third power has to be small. That's how it turns out to look. And this delta for an ADAF turns out to be something like 10 to the minus 4, 10 to the minus 5. So the expansion parameter in the problem for an ADAF is on the order of 10 to the minus 4. For the interstellar medium, the expansion parameter is again on the range of 10 to the minus 3, 10 to the minus 4. So that's the approximation that we're making, is in this parameter, okay, fundamentally. And several things are going to have to be small in this ordering for the problem to work. Well, K parallel over K perp is small because of the nice feature of this Goldreich-Sridhar cascade, which gives you K perp much larger than K parallel. The fluctuations are small. You can work this out from the GS paper, and you find that the electrostatic potential normalized by E over T goes like this number. K perp rho is of order 1. Beta might be 1, might be 1,000. The bigger beta is, the better the ordering works. And then you have this tiny number, delta. So clearly, the fluctuations, it turns out, at the tail of the Goldreich-Sridhar cascade are small. The fluctuations in the magnetic field are also small. Again, there's a number of order 1 times the small parameter in the problem, delta. In the delta B parallel, there's a little bit of complicated dependence on beta, but it's never very big. This is not a large correction. At small beta, you get one behavior, and at large beta, you get another behavior, so I just marked it this way. But fundamentally, all of the field perturbations in the Goldreich-Sridhar cascade turn out to be very small, of order delta, at the small scales, and so you're in a good shape to do turbulence. It's still strong turbulence. The whole cascade is strongly turbulent, but the fluctuations are small in this sense. This is important that you have to check that the frequencies remain small compared to the cyclotron frequency. And again, directly from the GS paper, you find that they also scale, all the frequencies in the problem scale like delta, and that the higher the beta, the better. So it's very nice, actually, that it worked out. Okay, and the collisionality regime, the gyrokinetics is okay as long as the collisionality is small compared to the ion cyclotron frequency. In fact, it's been developed mostly in the world as a collisionless limit, and that's where you find yourself. So, for example, in these ADAFs, you find the small scales are rho I, Then there's the size of the disk, and then this parallel lambda II is even bigger. So you're well into the collisionless regime. Okay. So I'm almost done. I just wanted... The next couple of slides, in fact, I'm going to skip them. You can take those equations and find the linear dispersion relation. And there's some algebra, which I'm not going to bore you with, but it'd be on the web if you wanted to check. This part of the talk, I'm going to recover the results of Gruzinov in Astrophysical Journal in the last year or two and show you that gyrokinetics has all the waves linearly that Elliot and Andre have been talking about, so that it's a good place to start to get the nonlinear dynamics. Okay, so we'll skip over a little. I'll just show you the dispersion relation that you get when it's all done. So here it is, and since I skipped the algebra, these signs, these symbols don't mean much, but I put this here. Schematically, this term here is the Schiele-Fein wave, and at small scales, it also gives you the Whistler that Gruzinov talked about. It's multiplying another wave here, which is the compressional mode, let's say something like a slow mode, which in this collisionless limit is very heavily damped. Okay? So you have this essentially undamped mode multiplying a heavily damped mode, and the coupling between them is this mess. But basically what you need to know is that the coupling is of order beta times k perp square rho I squared. And so, if you have Schiele-Fein cascade, as you go to higher beta and shorter scales, you couple to the damped part of the spectrum more and more effectively. And this is the argument, Gruzinov and Quatert, that at high enough beta, you will take all the energy from the Schiele-Fein cascade and dump it into this damped compressional-like mode, and it'll all get pulled away, and the ions, I didn't say this, the ions are actually getting all the heat from this damped compressional mode. And so this dispersion relation has all that physics in it. If your beta is too small, say equipartition fields, beta of order 1, then the argument goes that if this energy, that the Schiele-Fein is not effectively damped and it just keeps on evolving into short scale perturbations, which the ions will average over and you won't see it anymore. And they call those Whistlers. It's a non-standard use of the word Whistler, but we'll go on. So the point here is that this dispersion relation agrees with Gruzinov. It's got more details, but in the limit of interest, it agrees quite well. And the implication is that you could take these basic equations and extend what they're doing into the nonlinear regime to answer just the kinds of questions that they put into their paper, which are, okay, so we have modes that are propagating along these Schiele-Fein waves, nonlinearly interacting. How much, you can say that there's this much linear damping in the problem, but the real question is, nonlinearly, how much coupling is there from the linearly undamped to the linearly damped modes? And does the energy get through this region of k-space or not? Okay, and so it's essentially a nonlinear question, and their paper's very good, but it leaves you two or three orders of magnitude of uncertainty at the end. I apologize. It's the P. The P is a plasma dispersion function. Okay, and so when you go to the high beta limit, you'll get a resonance out of that. I'm sorry for the notation. That's exactly right. Okay, so in the last couple of minutes, I'm going to just talk about the very beginning, tell you briefly, try to convince you that the codes are actually interesting to use. It's a five-dimensional distribution function. Energy, these two together give you mu, and then you have three dimensions for space. And so that thing is broken into two parts. We use an operator splitting scheme. So all the linear terms, and the sources are treated implicitly. So the code implicitly gets all the Alfvén waves so that you can take steps which are large, if you wish, compared to an Alfvén wave, which allows you to do some interesting things. The collision operator is also treated implicitly, and the nonlinear term is evaluated explicitly, that's here, with a pseudospectral Adams-Bashforth second-order method. This is unintelligible bullet. And basically, the time step is adjusted dynamically to satisfy the Courant condition for the nonlinear term. But the fast frequencies in the problem are actually some electromagnetic waves flying around. And so it's very advantageous to make the code implicit so that you're not limited by these silly linear frequencies that you're not interested in. So an implicit, semi-implicit 5D code has to be parallel. And what I really want you to see here is the performance scales like this. The time per time step, so the wall clock per time step, basically goes like the number of mesh points divided by the number of processors to the 0.85. So it's not completely linear. It would be nice if it were. Still working on that. But this is reasonably good performance. And so the size calculations we do, if we were fluid turbulence guys, 512 cubed, that's the kind of box we use. We spread it over five dimensions instead of three dimensions. But 512 cubed, you can put that in for nmesh, and you'll find that it's a couple of seconds per time step on 512 processors of a T3E, which is, you know, a reasonable way to go, and so we can run and do the calculations. And the code's on the web. Anybody can get it. I'm happy to help anybody learn how to use it. It's written in general geometry. I mean, so you take any magnetic field, as long as the equilibrium magnetic field can be written in Clebsch coordinates, which they can, then that's the representation of the equilibrium field that the code uses. So we can do complicated problems if we wish. Because after all, the hard part in the fusion community was getting these complicated equilibria where we put crazy magnets on and make everything very complicated. So it's... That's right, yeah.
So you take that into
account. Mm-hmm. And that's just a picture showing you from small number of processors, just that formula, from a small number of processors to a large, it basically looks like to the 0.85 power. So I'd like to do better, but that's reasonable for an implicit code. What's that? If it's from the FFTs. It's from the data shuffling necessary to do the FFTs. That's right. So I'll be here for the rest of this week, and if anybody... what I wanted to do while I was here was to learn about the astrophysical problems that are out there. And so if you know of any interesting astrophysics problems and that look like this might be applicable to, I'd like to know about it. I'd like to work on it with people. The easy hook is that if you have the Shear-Alphane cascade and you're interested in, say, the particle fluctuations, the density fluctuations, or the heating at the small scales, that's just the kind of thing that we can calculate. And so that's a familiar object that you can translate. Yep.
Yeah, question. Yep.
Well, in the fusion community, we in the 1960s, people were about to give up because all they could get was Bohm diffusion out of the different devices. And it was a Russian program that first built a device which did better than Bohm in terms of the anomalous energy loss in the machine. That was a tokamak. Over the years, people have decided that, in fact, it is Bohm. It's just with a much lower coefficient. And then they've decided, no, it's not quite Bohm, it's something else. And the discussion over exactly what is anomalous transport, how does it scale with field and size and things like that, is ongoing and somewhat unresolved. I mean, for example, well, let's just leave it at that unless you want me to continue.
Whatever you were showing us today,
Well, it depends. Yeah, I guess it would be. The nice thing about taking an approach like this from first principles, I mean, we start with a Boltzmann equation with a well-defined collision operator. We take the low-frequency limit. We're not dropping anything. And computers have finally gotten fast enough that you can integrate the equations and even understand. There are people who are working out models of what they see in the nonlinear simulations and describing quantitatively what's going on. If you can take that approach, these codes can produce Bohm or gyrobohm, or these codes will tell you what the diffusion is. We have to be smart enough to figure out what the codes are telling us. But this approach is, I think, a good way to go, because along the way you'll find answers to that kind of question, I think. No, in fact there are. There's very good examples of using these codes to get Bohm diffusion. It's a Bohm scaling. So Bohm diffusion is some number times T over B, I guess, right? And you can get the T over B, and you might get a different number out front. But that's certainly of interest. Yeah. So that can fall out. All right. A typical spectrum in the problems that I'm familiar with has, it's strongly anisotropic. Let's not even talk about the parallel spectrum, but that tends, okay, I don't know off the top of my head exactly what I get there. In the perpendicular direction, which is what we diagnose in fusion plasmas all the time, there's a preferred direction. The perpendicular symmetry is broken. Because this is that same picture, but it's just now one plane, okay? And these white lines represent the field lines. And so you can see the field lines go around. And the point here is that the field is dominantly into the board. So the perpendicular direction is in this plane. But the perpendicular, as you go around the field line, there's a big difference in the radial direction and the poloidal direction. And you can see from the fluctuations that there's a big difference. In some places, the fluctuations have a very long wavelength in the radial direction and a very short wavelength in the perpendicular to that direction. And in other parts of the plasma, they have roughly isotropic type behavior. And so one has to be careful from trying to abstract what's going on in this curved magnetic field into maybe what we would expect to see at larger scales, where maybe the flux tubes aren't curving very much. But fundamentally, you see in one of the perpendicular directions a bump at maybe 10 or 20 gyroradii, and in the other direction it smoothly goes, it's peaked at zero, but there's some power law fall off. I'm talking about a density fluctuation spectrum, that's right. So in one case, it's a power law type behavior. In the other case, there's a bump and then a power law. But I think that the details, the key thing is the width of each spectrum is measured in rho I. So you would expect to see, well, they know about the ion gyro radius, and you don't see in these calculations typically spectra which are varying on some other scale. So even if it's peaked at zero, the width is going to be measured in inverse gyro radii, let's say, if you're talking about a K spectrum.
There's
I see. Well, that would be interesting. You would get bumps out of this. I didn't really talk in terrible detail. At the very end, I showed you a dispersion relation, showed you a shear Alphane wave and the coupling to a compressional mode. The compressional mode has associated with it density fluctuations. And so if you get to a situation where beta is sufficiently large and K-perp rho is getting to be of order 1, shear Alphane wave starts driving up density fluctuations. And so that's why that's the genesis of my comment that I expected to see density fluctuations at the rho I-ish scale. I don't know. I haven't done a calculation. I mean, with this physics that we're talking about here, actually with the code yet, so I don't know. But that's what I suspect we're going to get as a bump. But we'll have to see. It's a velocity distribution. So you have, why not 6? Is that your question? Yeah. Because one of the velocity directions is round and round, the cyclotron motion. We average over that. Right. No, this is a 5D solution. That's right, continuum code. There's a community of people that use particles, generally my competitors. I'm their competitor, whatever. But both techniques have proven very valuable over time. Here, I mean, there's a trade-off, right? In a particle code, in a nonlinear particle calculation, it's difficult to assess the importance of noise. And they're always challenged to run with more and more particles to show that they're converged, and, you know, funny things happen sometimes. You find that you thought you were converged over a long period, and then something changes. The continuum version has a similar, I mean, we have a complementary drawback. We have to show more and more resolution in velocity space. Doesn't matter to the problem. So typically right now we have 500 points in velocity space at every grid, and those points are in energy and pitch angle, which are these conserved quantities. So there are various diagnostics that I go through to show that things are well behaved, but at the end of the day, people will say, rightfully, okay, double the resolution and show me that the answer doesn't change. I mean, that's the nature of the numerical world, right? So they're complementary and actually work with people, although we go to meetings and we stand up and flog each other, but then between meetings we work together.
But you're not evolving the field, right?
I'm evolving the perturbed field, but not the equilibrium field. So let's put it in the picture of, say, the interstellar medium. There's some large-scale magnetic field, and then there are perturbations on that associated with the cascade. Perturbations are being evolved. Large-scale magnetic field is not.
Yeah. And the DBS cascade really only applies to the case of the presence of large-scale field.
Of the what?
It applies to the presence of the large-scale field. Is that right? If you don't have an S...
I believe that's right. Jason, you know. You got to have a large-scale field before you get a GS cascade, right? Right. Right.
Right. But if you have a big enough box, you don't have large scale field within the box.
Ah, but this whole box will remain small compared to that. That's the nature of this expansion parameter. So we can work through that. But basically, there is this small parameter that we had to check. You know, is so for example, let me put it in different concrete terms. Yeah. So it's a little bit tough in the case of the disk, because I think the fundamental question in the case of a hot disk is, what is the driver of this large-scale shear alphane turbulence? Let's assume that there is something like that. Well, what is it? I actually have trouble believing it's an MRI instability, because I don't see that that's unstable in a collisionless plasma. But that's something that we have to look into, I think. If it is an MRI, then that'll give you some scale, some outer scale at which stuff is going on. And if that's of order the radius of the disk or the height of the disk, which are comparable, you can do this calculation. There's enough scale separation to go forward. Well, thank you all for coming.
Thank you again.
Appreciate it.